Hey, it's the Wallflowers. That's a great way to start off the morning. The Wallflowers, they'll be our bumper music today. Going to be playing the Mehewi in Great Barrington tonight at 8 p.m. Mehewi.org for more information. You going tonight, Alan?
No.
Well, that's a shame. I'm sure they'd love to see you.
Well, they would, but I go to sleep at 6 o'clock at night.
Yeah, I know. So, but you don't have to get up early tomorrow.
No, it's not that easy just to turn off your clock, your internal clock. David Soares is nodding very sagaciously. I understand.
You know, there's obviously it's Bob Dylan's son. It's
oh, Rosella's definitely going.
Oh, she is going.
Oh, she's going.
Oh, see that, you should have led with that.
Without me.
The Wallflowers at the Mehewi tonight, and you can find out more by going to Mehewi.org. It'll be a great show. I've seen the Wallflowers. They're amazing. They put on an amazing show. Really fun. Let me introduce everybody to you. Welcome to Friday. It is the 20th of May, 14 minutes past 9 o'clock. We couldn't be more happy to have you here. It's supposed to go up to 90 degrees this weekend.
Mm.
And so this is our last time where we'll be somewhat comfortable with ourselves for at least the weekend. But, you know, we'll take it. Let me introduce the group. I want to remind you, you can write in. panel@wamc.org, and we'd love to hear what is on your mind this morning. Hey, Alan.
Hey, Joe.
Good morning.
I never, ever, you know, go to sleep past, you know, 6:30. So that's just the way
it
is.
See, I feel that's a misnomer.
Why is that?
Because I often, like, I will get texts from you at 11:30.
Oh, I wake up. I wake up and say, I better write to Joe now.
But it's.
I better write to Joe now.
But I mean, it's like, I mean, at what point does 6 o'clock just become a nap? And then how do you differentiate?
No, you go to bed at 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
And then you fall fast asleep.
All right, so let me ask you this question.
And then you wake up and you do business.
Is 6 o'clock jammy time?
Oh, absolutely.
And what time do you eat dinner?
What? I don't eat dinner. Nope. Lunch is the last meal for me. That's something I believe in.
You know what's lucky about you is that...
What is it, David?
many things.
What is lucky about him, David?
I'm just saying, because I have this thing about people who... I'm always warning people not to put so much information out there about themselves.
Yeah, you warned
media,
me about that.
You know? But you're lucky that burglars don't work the 6:30 shift. Because it's like the only house that you could probably
right.
go hit at 6:45. Try to do it between the windows, 6:45
no,
and 11:30.
And still make a movie at the triplex. Yeah,
Roselle's up till 1 o'clock. She's guarding the house. And
good.
Murray, the
and
dog,
Murray,
won't
and
take
Murray.
It.
Good.
Yeah.
Don't, good, good.
Yeah, but you did warn me. About walking in the dark around Lake Mansfield.
Walking in the dark.
And you told me, don't do that because everybody will know you're there and somebody will basically kill you.
Well, you know what? I'm not only concerned about them harming you, I'm more concerned about them seeing you in person and debating you.
Oh, yeah. You know? That's a good point.
I think, you
what
know,
did you say about
Yeah, that time 3 weeks ago when you were talking about President Biden, they're getting you know.
Yeah, I hear you,
Judy. What time do you go to sleep?
You know, I sadly go to bed. I try to stay up until 10.
Yeah,
sometimes it's not.
It's hard.
It's hard.
Yeah.
But I get up at 5. So.
Judy Patrick is the Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, and we thank you for being here. Appreciate it. Always nice to have you here. Mark Whitman joins us, investment banker on Wall Street. Had a nice, calm week.
What should we buy this week? I always ask him the same question.
I know.
What should we buy?
Don't I give you... I've given you the same answer recently.
Well, that doesn't stop it.
Buy nothing.
Well, look, we've talked about I-bonds, right, which are the... U.S. government issued
right.
Treasury securities. You buy them directly from, I think it's U.S. or what is it?
Gov.us or whatever.
Yeah. Treasury.gov. And they protect you against inflation. So for lots of folks, there's been lots in the press about it. For lots of folks, that makes sense. for people and institutions with very large portfolios who've got money invested, the recommendation, obviously subject to checking it with the proper authorities, is that with all the expectations around food and other commodity prices increasing for the next couple years, that some portion of your investable funds, long-term investable funds, should be in a commodity fund.
Knowing that you're responsible for other people's money, how do you sleep at night?
Yeah, that's a good point.
It depends if he's using other people's money.
Yeah, maybe I should explain what I do. I advise primarily food and beverage companies, but if you look at what, for instance, not nearly as high profile, but for instance, what Elon Musk is doing with Twitter, where one public company talks about buying part of or all of another, that's the sort of thing I do. So there aren't really individuals involved.
Well, no, but there's investors involved, right? There's investors in those businesses.
Yeah, I sleep very well because I consistently make solid recommendations. How's
and
that?
Solid money.
What? You seem so... Wait, just a point of personal privilege.
Sure, of course.
Alan.
Whatever.
So you... Here's a man who founded and still runs this institution. I think your name's above the door, right?
I ain't saying.
Which it enlightens and entertains so many. You've been married to your wife for how long?
51 years.
If I need to be the one to break it to you about how wealthy you are, sir, I'm happy to share that information with you.
No, I'm not wealthy. I'm not a wealthy man at all.
In terms of what counts.
I see, yeah.
Hey, David Soares, district attorney for the County of Albany, want to get in on this conversation?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm just happy to be here with Matt again and Patrick.
Are you rich?
Me?
Yeah.
I'm always 35 cents away from having a quarter.
Okay. Yeah, that's a great way of putting it.
Yeah, that's
a great way.
Right,
that's a great way of doing it.
Yeah. My mom used to give me $2 when I was a kid to sweep the driveway. That was my allowance, $2 a week. I think back in the early 80s, I think I was able to get more for my $2 than the allowance that my wife gives me right now.
Oh, now, but this is none of my business, but I don't care how much money you make, but because we can just look it up. But when you go into court and you're against somebody else, how much more are they making?
Oh, they're making so much more.
Don't you ever think, I should be over there?
You know what's more pathetic is when cases are assigned out because of conflicts of interest.
Yes.
And you see the bills that the special prosecutors submit for payment.
Oh, boy.
And you try to hide that stuff from the rest of your staff so that they're not all... leaving your office to become special prosecutors.
Well, sure,
right?
Yeah.
It speaks.
I think it speaks to your character and it speaks to the character of your staff that they want to do the people's business and to work in trying to improve the system at large as opposed to making
money. I have such gratitude and respect for public servants because teachers. It's not about money. It's something else that drives. People that are in service. Mm-hmm. And
sure.
I think we need to come back to a place and time when we are honoring people who are in service. The system doesn't work. None of it works without folks who are geared towards, being in the service of others. But I just want to say one thing, man. My man right here, there's two things I've gotten from the show, right?
Yep.
Inverted yield curves. I throw that around randomly. I throw that around so randomly, and people, when you throw those words together, people look at you and be like, oh my God, he's on a different level.
Yeah.
And now, aperture of horror. Aperture of horror.
It's right here. It's a little notebook I keep. And when people say things, just little turns of phrase that I find interesting and amusing, I will write them down. And that did make the book. That's pretty great. So we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will get to your letters in just a bit. First, we have to talk about something. So we'll do that now. Let's talk about the recession and fears of recession since we are sort of on that topic. The U.S. may be barreling toward recession in the next year, according to more experts than we morning we had the first group of experts. Now we have more experts. Recession risks are high, uncomfortably high, and rising, according to a leading economist. The U.S. economy could be heading for a recession in the next year, according to growing warnings from banks and economists, as a sudden bout of pessimism hammers financial markets, which on Thursday spiraled further from recent highs. Although major swaths of the economy, including the job market and consumer spending, remain robust, there are mounting worries that rising borrowing costs for consumers and businesses after years of near zero interest rates could cause a sudden retrenchment. The Federal Reserve has raised interest rates by 0.75 percentage points so far this year, while officials are signaling more aggressive increases could be necessary to cool the economy. Continued uncertainty from the coronavirus pandemic and Russia's invasion of Ukraine are adding to the uneasiness. Mark Whitman?
Well, first, Joe, as listeners of this program know, when they read the press and the press mentions interest rates are sort of, in a way, a byproduct of the Fed shrinking the money supply. The real problem, the reason we have such inflation, the reason the Fed's going to put the brakes on, and the reason, given the other economic shocks, that's more likely than not next year to lead to a recession, is because the money supply is too high. Talking about interest rates is the shorthand that the press, for some reason, has tended to. So everyone, when they hear that, should understand that the real issue is that the money supply grew by 40% starting in 2000. Asset prices had to respond to that. There was nowhere for the money to go but to basically bid up asset prices. And they've got to contract significantly for the inflation to abate. And that's and in order to do that, the Fed's going to shrink the money supply.
So how does that happen, that the money supply grows? Do the monies, the $5 bills, have babies? I mean, what?
not in Oklahoma.
Yes, they have little Lincoln. What happens is, you know, the old adage you may have learned was the Fed, quote unquote, prints money.
Right, they print money.
Yeah, the real way.
The Fed always said that.
And the other way people refer to it as the Fed's bloated balance sheet. But the real way it happens mechanically is the Fed went out into the market, bought U.S. government treasuries, credited the former holder of those treasuries with dollars in their account. They don't actually print them. They just make the notation in the electronic system. And there you are. The system has more money in it. Now what the Fed's going to do is—
That doesn't sound right.
It doesn't sound right in what sense?
Well, the Fed
should be consistently growing the money supply to accommodate growth in the economy. When the pandemic came, the concern was everyone was going to sit on their cash, terrified as to what was going to be next, and not spend anything. So the Fed wanted everybody to basically feel well. The government wanted everybody to feel wealthier. The government sent out checks. The Fed, instead of borrowing that money, or the government, instead of taxing that money, literally just created that money by buying debt securities out of the market.
That doesn't sound right.
Well, they overdid it. That was hard to tell then, and they should have started constraining the money supply much sooner than they had. And now what you're seeing in the markets, when you hear volatility, there are two emotions that sort of work in contrast with one another in the markets in the short run. They are fear and greed. And when you hear that volatility is up, what you should hear is that fear is up. People are afraid. They don't know what to do. Maybe
volatility meaning buying and selling. And
volatility meaning the rate at which the market changes its price levels up and down.
Right.
Okay. So what volatility has gone very high now. And that what that tells you is people are fearful as to what happens and what they should do. In calmer times when the market's rising, there's far less volatility. So that's why the market's up 1,000 or down 1,000 points one day, up 500 the next, and it's hard to figure out in the short term what's going on. But it's very clear to investors now, and I said this a couple weeks ago, that rates were rising and the equity markets hadn't gotten the joke. It's very clear to investors now that when we get into next year, the Fed will have clamped down on the money supply enough, and there are enough supply shocks, the war in Ukraine, its effect on food, energy, that it's likely to choke off economic growth for some period of time, which is what we call a recession, depending. It's defined now a couple of different ways.
So with a recession coming, what should we, the people in this room, what should we do?
Well, the answer is, and I think I responded to this the first time you asked me, was none of your money should be in the markets if you can't put it there and close your eyes for the next 5 years.
So you really should be rich to be in the market.
Well, you should have money that you don't need for 5 years. Now, some people do that as a part of retirement planning, and other people, and sort of normal planning for events that are far into the future, for instance, the education of a child, when they can afford to do it. Now, look, if you can't afford it, you can't afford to be in the market, then it's a matter of battening down the hatches to get through this recession, which is going to be difficult.
So, Judy, what do you do?
Well, yeah, you sit tight, you don't sell. But the point here is that it's not just rich people who are in the market now. Our government has encouraged us all to have 401ks instead of having company-supplied pensions.
Right.
And so a large number of Americans are relying on these 401ks, which are typically mutual funds, and they're going to have to weather it. But one of my issues is, what happened? So in a recession, does that mean plants close down, that unemployment goes up? I mean, what is the real danger from a personal perspective of a recession?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, technically, a recession...
Is it a good question that you can answer in 30 seconds?
Go.
A recession is two
I mean, if
or
you
can,
say
quarters.
No, and I'll give you time on the other side.
Yeah, I think we should wait to the other
side.
We'll
go to the other side.
It's very interesting. I think what he's saying is going to be very interesting.
Thank you, David.
David has a worried look on his face.
I appreciate your guidance in this matter. I appreciate your counsel, as always, sir. We'll take a break, and we'll be right back. And when will we be back? I don't know. David will let me know, and we'll be all set right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us, Alan Chartok, Mark Whitman, Judy Patrick, and David Soares making up the group. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Is recession a foregone conclusion?
No, it's more likely than not. And it would be, if you talk to the smart economists, and by the way, I should be intellectually honest. There's a guy who used to be a college classmate of mine who has an app. It's free. It's called The Inflation Guy. And if you want to learn more about all this sort of stuff, he's
The Inflation Guide.
The Inflation Guy, G-U-Y. Oh, guy. He's got a little picture of himself in a superhero costume. Mm-hmm. But he does great work. if you want to learn more
Seems
about...
like he needs some help in marketing.
What college was that?
I think it's a little tongue-in-cheek, but he has great work. I mean, he's been the inflation guy for a long time. Finally, the circumstances caught up with him, and now he's met with some bit of business press fame because he's got the right name at the right time. But so the question is, what happens? Is it inflation a foregone conclusion? No, it's more likely than not. It'd be really tough to see our way past it because you got the Fed constraining the money supply, which will decrease activity. And you've also got the shocks around, particularly the war in Ukraine, the food and energy price shocks, and all the follow-on effects that those are going to have for the economy in the U.S. and around the world. You've also got lockdowns in China, and there's a whole list we've talked about before. So to Judy's question, what happens in a recession? A recession used to be technically defined as two or more quarters of negative growth in GDP. The Conference Board wants to use a fancier definition. I'll leave it to others to look that up. But what does unemployment go up? Yes, it will. Does business activity dampen significantly? Yes, it will. On a personal effect, you know, Alan Greenspan had a great line. He said, unemployment for the individual is a binomial statistic. You either lose your job or you don't. So if you don't, you'll weather the biggest part of the biggest difficulty associated with a recession. And as people are learning now, they're going to have to change their ways in terms of spending now that everything's gotten so enormously more expensive.
So I have a question, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
So what should we do? I mean, what should we do?
Well, I've talked about the investment side, which is nothing for 5 years. And if you're not in a position where you can't close your eyes for 5 years, you need to talk to an advisor who can put you into that position, assuming you have the funds available to make long-term investments. Someone called in once when we were talking about student loans, and I was talking about I-bonds, and said, what do you mean $10,000 in I-bonds? I can't pay my student loans. On the what should we do side, I'll give you a perspective. As I say, I cover food companies. And every once in a while, they lose the consumer sort of disappears. And it's not that the consumer stops buying food, but the consumer does some important things to save money on their food bills. They stay inside as opposed to going out.
Yeah.
They trim waste. If you go to the grocery store, the largest item on your grocery list is an item you don't know it's there. It's waste. Everyone in our economy throws away you know, more food than they eat of any single other item on their expense list. So that's one way to cut your bill quite substantially.
Just don't waste anything.
Waste as little as possible and pay attention to it as a family. That's actually important.
So give us an example of one thing that we could be doing that would avoid, you know, our wasting.
I think in my house we call them leftovers. I mean, it's simple. It's that simple. It's, you know, a lot of people end up throwing away food once it's gone bad because they haven't paid attention to it. The other thing you can do is de-inventory your house. A lot of people bought a lot of crazy things during the pandemic. You probably have a box of something strange in the back.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're not going to eat it, for God's sake, at least give it to a food pantry before it goes bad. The other thing you can do to
How do you know when it's going to go bad? Don't you see?
You check the date on the back.
The expiration date.
Yeah, expiration dates are a good guide.
Oh, I see. I get it now.
And then the other thing, excuse me,
I got to go home and check the expiration dates in my refrigerator.
Well,
the other thing that families can do, and actually it's probably good for you health-wise, it's probably good for the environment, is try to cut meats out of the diet as much as reasonably possible.
Because
that's an expensive item, and if you have spaghetti once a week without meat, that helps.
David, would you like to respond to that?
I was with my brother up until he just said that.
I didn't say cut it out. I just said reduce it.
But I didn't go, look. Judy had a look on her face when that was.
Well,
my
look was, you don't know about expiration dates.
I know about expiration dates. Because what do you mean I don't know?
You know, I'm notorious in my family for having food in my refrigerator that's 2 or 3
years after.
You know.
Now, will you eat it or not?
Well, after several bouts of food poisoning, I have decided I'm going to be more safe than I have in the past. But what I'll do
is—have you really gotten food poisoning?
Oh my God, yeah, oh yeah. So yes,
I'm impressed.
But yeah, if it's fuzzy, I won't eat it. But
what do you mean fuzzy?
You know, with mold on it.
Seems to be a good rule of thumb.
Yeah, but it doesn't. But I buy the big containers of things thinking it's more cost effective. But what happens is I don't finish the yogurt, the quart yogurt in time. And
you should buy the smaller ones.
Right. It's more expensive, but in the long run, I will not.
George Carlin used to say that leftovers make you feel good twice. First,
no,
I'm saving food. And then 2 weeks later, when it has hair growing out of it, you throw it away and you say, I'm saving my life.
Look, man.
Oh, here it comes.
I'm an immigrant, all right? And my family, 5 kids coming over here from West Africa and throwing food away? Y'all are nuts. That's a date.
It's a suggestion.
It's just, hey, listen, we don't look at that. And if it's not walking, you know, by the time you get to it, just. You can use your knife.
Push it aside.
Use your knife, get all the fuzzy stuff out, and then go to it.
The fuzzy stuff.
Yeah.
But it makes it's an interesting point about the expiration dates, because this is a frequent question in our house, where you go in and you're looking for, I don't know, peas. And you look at the peas and you say, oh, those expired in 2018. Do I eat the can of peas or do I not eat the can of peas? And then you think to yourself, well, like, what could happen to a can of peas?
Sometimes they explode. They get really
I mean, they're not
big
open.
They're very old.
But now I rule on the side of caution and say, oh, well, let's not eat the peas.
It's 50 cents.
That's well, right. And to the food pantry part, but I feel also guilty giving old food to the food pantry. I would rather just give them a check and let them buy new food.
I didn't say expired food, but...
No, I know you
do. Do what makes sense. Yeah, by the way, the other thing I should have mentioned is a lot of people, and the retailers this week, Target and Walmart, and their announcements, cited that people are trading down in terms of brands, and where your family's comfortable doing that, it makes a lot of sense. I work with many of the branded food manufacturers, so I would never mention on the air that you'd be surprised to find out how much of the private label is or store brands are manufactured in the exact same plant with the exact same ingredients.
Target has some of the best crunchy peanut butter.
There you go.
I'm just saying, it's not a brand.
And look, that's the food element of people's budget. Obviously, housing, right, transportation are other areas where people have got to look to batten down the hatches as best they can. The good news is we get through these things. I was once following the crash of 87, I was at a speaking engagement by a Nobel laureate who was heavily invested in the market. And he said his wife turned to him and said, what do we do if it goes to zero? And he turned to his wife and he said, "We buy it all." I mean, eventually we'll come out of this.
Yeah, we buy it all. All right, let's go to a couple letters here. Can you speak to the great disparity of wealth in this country and how that impacts the economy? Doesn't the wealth concentration in the top percentile impact the economy and available funds?
I think it's not helpful to the economy, and I also think probably more germane to present conversation. It's not helpful to our political situation at all, frankly. And I think we're reaping some of the benefits of the great inequity that we've created in this country.
I mean, I was looking at the real estate section of the Financial Times before we came in, and the former head of Johnson & Johnson, his home in Long Island just sold for $45 million.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Was it pretty?
It had a lot of beachfront.
Yeah,
it had a pool.
That'll do it.
Yeah. Ed writes to us, who benefits from all the folks running from the market now? The rich who are able to stay in the market? Is this one of the ways in which the rich get richer and the poor get poorer?
It is. If you run from the market now, you face the prospect of paying taxes on your gains, suffering some of the, even though you're going to suffer some of the losses, some 18% decline, and then you're going to have to, by the way, figure out when to put it back in, which is another challenge when you take it out. If you have funds and you can put your fingers in your ear and let it ride, you'll do better, which is why in the long run, if you have a long-term plan, volatility is your friend. That's why you get paid more for being in the equity market. But if you get off the roller coaster halfway, you're likely to break an ankle.
That's a great way to put it. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll move on to other topics. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back.
That's my mojo you're using. That's my wine getting you drunk.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Listening to the Wallflowers this morning. They're playing at the Mehewi in Great Barrington tonight at 8 p.m. You can find out more by going to mehewi.org.
Roselle's going.
Mehewi at W.
I think you really like saying that word.
What, Mehewi?
Mehewi.
I love saying Mehewi.
Not everybody can.
Hi, Dina. How are you? Welcome.
Good. Thank you.
Hi.
How does Roselle like going to things by herself?
She's used to it. She's an independent person. She's an independent woman, which drives me crazy. We are also on different schedules. I mean, you know, I get up at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Wait a minute. It was 3 when we started this show.
No, it'll be 11.
No. But that's true. I was really up at 2 this morning.
What contributes to the success of your relationship is not having one.
We never see each other.
Okay. That's good.
That's not good.
Well.
I don't mind seeing stuff alone, though. I like that. I mean, sometimes it's nice to go with other people. I'm not saying that. But sometimes if you just want to immerse yourself into the performance, it's nice just to be by yourself. Everyone's looking at me loudly.
That's what I find when I go to sleep.
Yeah, all right. well, that's another issue too, isn't it? Irene says, this topic is so interesting. Food and money. The idea that people who don't have 2 nickels to rub together should find a way to cut back is really hard to take. Not everyone has a 5-year plan, and they're waiting on food pantry lines or, if lucky, working in restaurants and getting a free meal. They want to eat good food as well.
I don't know that I missed that part of the show.
Point taken. No, point taken that people are concerned about food. We know that.
For those of us who have started or have partners starting retirement in 2023, we're now beginning to pull from our retirement accounts or living expenses. How do we not stay in the market if we won't begin Social Security for at least another 4 years?
Yeah, the trick on that 5-year rule is to actually start withdrawing from the market. If you're, say, 5 years out from retirement, you withdraw the first year's worth of retirement funds. Actually, that's when they do go into something like, say, really safe, like I-bonds, for instance. And then when you're 2 years away, you draw out the second year. So you actually always have safe cash in hand that you can use 5 years from now. It's sort of an unwind on the other side of that. And again, Joe, I want to acknowledge the previous writer's good point, which is some people are at a point because of their circumstances and the timing in life where they can do planning like that. And I get it. There are some people in our society right now who are, you know, trying to figure out how to feed their babies and pay for it, or in food lines. I mean, there's obviously a wide gambit of needs, wants, and financial abilities.
And there are a lot of us who don't do any planning at all.
Yeah, there are people.
I mean, we don't do any planning. We don't say, okay, we'll take this much out to use next year. We just don't do that.
Yeah, well,
we're just lucky.
The idea, you can get lucky, or better yet, you can start planning. It's never too late to start. You've got obviously got to seek the right resources.
Okay, how many years do I have? I'm going to be 81 this summer. How many years do I have to do that planning? What would you say?
I don't know when you plan to retire, but 5 years before you do, I would start thinking about
having...
5 years before you do, I would start thinking about de-risking each year's worth of spending that you're going to have in the future.
All right, let's change the subject. President Biden hailed Finland and Sweden's decision to join NATO as a watershed moment in European security, saying the entry of two well-armed, robust democracies would strengthen the Western alliance at a time of acute tension with Russia. Welcoming the Nordic nations' leaders in the White House Rose Garden, Biden said their decision following President Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine to abandon a decades-old position of military non-alignment proved that a revised NATO could provide a strong counterweight to autocracy and aggression. President Biden, in his remarks yesterday, said, "Standing together today, we reject the bloody creed that might makes right, and we declare a more powerful creed, all for one and one for all." Because what makes NATO strong isn't just our enormous military capacity, but our commitment to each other, to its values. NATO is an alliance of choice, not coercion. Judy?
Well, they really welcomed Finland and Sweden so quickly that it revived the question I had in my head is, why are they so resistant to accepting Ukraine at the beginning? You look at the criteria for Finland for being accepted into NATO, and it's, you have to have a vibrant economy, you have to, anti-corruption measures. Maybe Ukraine wasn't so good on the anti-corruption, but they've been struggling to get into NATO for a long time. Why? The bottom line is there was political resistance. They didn't want to antagonize Russia, but now I guess they figure Russia's pretty well antagonized. There's nothing they can do to edge them on further.
Hmm. Well, I suspect that Western democracies don't have to worry too much about antagonizing Russia. I think that would be a given in all of this.
Yeah, if you look at Finland, they've actually got a larger artillery force than any other European country. They and Sweden are actually more capable militarily. They never really took a peace dividend at the end of the Cold War. Mm-hmm. They can work in step with NATO more readily than even some of the junior partners in NATO. And I actually think the twist here is that Putin really doesn't mind. He's not going to attack NATO. He knows that. He wasn't going to attack Finland. He knows that. And he's happy because it helps buttress his internal encirclement argument, the sort of the beef he has against the West. This makes it more clear. So he really doesn't lose anything here either.
I don't know. I don't know that I agree with him not losing anything. This is one of the most historical missteps that any leader of any country has ever taken. He's literally lost everything, right? And just to go back to your analysis of the Ukraine, I think NATO has always been concerned about the Ukraine because it still has a Russian influence within its borders. And I think that that's also part of the hesitation of and some reluctance in not accepting them into NATO. But, what a week it has been for Vladimir Putin. And the other day when that influential military general made the remarks that he made on state-run television, that was very significant. Now, he backtracked the following day, but I think it's not too difficult to read in between the lines as to what happened that forced him to come back and rethink his position and opinion. But it's going to be interesting to see how Russia just continues to move along here. I think some of the analysis that we're seeing and reading is, you know, a slow, ongoing conflict. But how long can that last?
So, David, if you were trying to get inside of Putin's mind, what do you think has motivated this very aggressive position that he's taken?
Well, I don't know that he's now I'm beginning to doubt some of the assessments that were made early on about him wanting the entirety of the country. I think his mindset has been all along in taking that eastern region and owning the various ports. But boy, he definitely didn't bring his best tools. And we now are discovering that his military was not as up to snuff as we had always perceived.
You know, the thought was that this Mariupol steel plant was something that the Russians could take over and run and make some real money out of. But what they did is they destroyed it. And now they're talking, well, maybe they'll just make that city a resort. You know, a resort city going forward. That plant was a 4 square mile plant that employed 10,000 people that generated a ton of steel, and now it was an economic resource that he's destroyed, and he's not going to have any more. But they'll clear it all away apparently, and people can go to the beach there.
So Judy, was he just stupid? In other words, the question is, if everybody in this room can see this was a false move. What is it that he was thinking he could get away with? See, my feeling is, in the beginning, he thought he could, and a lot of other people thought he could, and I thought he could, because, you know, that was his playbook. But once he saw this was not going to happen,
Maybe he's one of those guys who can't admit he's made a mistake.
He may be.
And perhaps this Russian general being allowed to say what he did on Russian state TV, maybe that's a sign of some internal conflict there, or maybe Putin is setting the stage to say, yeah, well, we didn't get everything we wanted. You never know what's going on.
I don't believe that he can never say that. And the problem that he's experiencing now is that what incentives are there for the Ukrainians to come to the table and engage in some kind of settlement? Mm-hmm. I think mm-hmm. maybe 3 weeks ago there could have been some discussion about, you know, allowing Crimea to just, you know, lawfully become part of Russia. I think with all of their military success, there is little incentive for them to come to the table and acquiesce to any piece of real estate, you know, relinquishing any piece of real estate to the Russians.
We have a letter from Suzanne who said, what about Hungary and Turkey? Not exactly Western democracies.
Right, and Turkey's been obstructing the effort to get Finland and Sweden in. We'll see. Apparently, they're trying to give Turkey some sort of concession to make them get out of the way. Could be a large amount of money.
And there's also sales, I believe, some sales of F-15 or F-35 fighters that are pending. So I think there'll be a lot of discussions with Erdogan in the coming weeks. And by the way, Turkey has not stated, they've not declared that they won't, vote to allow for Sweden and Finland to come into NATO. They haven't declared that, but
they're making noise.
They are making noise. The other thing too to bear in mind is that Erdogan is up for re-election, I believe, next year, and he also has, I hate to say it, but a Trumpian core within his electorate. So a lot of what is happening now on the international stage is believed to appease that constituency.
The Ukrainian foreign minister yesterday complained that NATO as an institution has done next to nothing to help in this conflict. I mean, the NATO countries have, but he was more thankful to the European Union, who he says has stepped up far more than NATO has. So he's basically saying NATO has been useless to us.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Our panel this morning, Alan Chartok, Judy Patrick, David Soares, Mark Whitman, we welcome your letters. Panel@wamc.org. First messages and news with Ray Graff. Good stuff. Wallflower is playing the Mehewi tonight, 8 p.m., mehewi.org. Nice work, Mike. Thank you for providing music that I don't want to stop listening to.
Guy's on fire today.
Yeah, he is. He's on fire. Absolutely on fire today. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable, and I welcome you. We all welcome you. We want your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we're interested in what is on your mind. Let's go to some other topics here as we roll through our list of priorities. Actually, just a couple letters real quick to finish up on NATO and Ukraine. What's taking place right now in Ukraine, writes Anthony, is why it was never allowed into NATO war. Had Ukraine become a member, we would be knees deep in World War III. Unfortunately, Ukraine had that big red nuclear button tattooed on its being. Then we go to
That's a good letter.
Judy writes, not our Judy, a different Judy. How can Ukraine be, at least I think so, how can Ukraine be admitted to NATO? I thought membership means on the ground defense of one another. Isn't Ukraine membership in NATO already precluded by years of Russian invasion?
I don't think it's technically precluded, but I think it's...
I just looked at a sea of eyes staring at me, so I'll
I think the answer on. The answer is the previous letter. It's not technically precluded, but it's been practically precluded because it's Russia's backyard and in a geography they've expressed interest in.
And let's see. How can Ukraine be admitted to NATO? I just read that. I think the reason that Ukrainian membership in NATO was never offered was because we simply don't want to poke the bear. All right.
Probably true.
Let's move on to other stuff. And we go to the Oklahoma abortion law. This is, I'm going to say it's quite a story, and it is. I mean, David alluded to it earlier, but obviously it's becoming more and more common in these United States of America. The Oklahoma legislature gave final approval on Thursday to a bill that prohibits nearly all abortions starting at fertilization, which would make it the nation's strictest abortion law. The bill allows private individuals to sue abortion providers and anyone who, quote, aids or abets an abortion. It would take effect immediately if signed by Governor Kevin Stitt, a Republican who has pledged to make Oklahoma the most anti-abortion state in the nation. State Representative Jim Olson, a Republican and a man, said there can be nothing higher or more critical than the defense of innocent unborn life. The measure is modeled on a law that took effect in Texas in September, which banned abortion after about 6 weeks and has relied on civilian instead of criminal enforcement to work around court challenges. Because of that provision, the law explicitly says state authorities cannot bring charges. The U.S. Supreme Court and state courts have said they cannot block the ban, even if it goes against the constitutional right to abortion established in Roe v. Wade. The Oklahoma ban goes further than the Texas law, which bans abortion after about 6 weeks of pregnancy.
Well, the competition between states to see who can deprive women of their liberties. We'll continue to move. I don't understand where – I don't see where you can go beyond Oklahoma. I mean, the next state that will attempt to pass some piece of legislation so that they can look like they're the most enthusiastic about protecting the life of the unborn, I don't see where you go beyond Oklahoma. But that doesn't mean that some other fool isn't going to try.
Well, there'll be other states and other laws. Judy.
Well, I thought to myself, Oklahoma must really care about families, especially babies and mothers. So I did some research and I found out that 1 in 5 Oklahoman children live in poverty. That's 20%. The percentage is even higher among Black and Latino children. 38% and 27% live in poverty. About 86,000 children, roughly 9% of the kids in Oklahoma, don't have health insurance. Let's see. They have traditionally low birth weight among the children that are born. It's 8.2% of their births are low rate. And let's talk about maternal death. Oklahoma is one of the worst states when it comes to women who die in childbirth. The rate is 23.5% of every 100,000 deaths those women die. 23.5. Now California, for by contrast, has 4.5. So it shows you how bad it is when it comes to women who die in childbirth.
I'm sorry. Did I miss something? The percentage of women who die while giving birth is what?
Oh, it's not 23. It's 23.5 per 100,000 births.
Okay. All right.
Texas is then that number's 34. Florida, that number's 23. New York doesn't have a great number either. The other important fact I found was the Medicaid waiver waiting list. This is the list that you get on if you have a child or anyone who has profound disabilities and needs help. That list is 13 years long. So if you have a child born who has special needs and needs care, you might have to wait as long as 13 years before you get service. So perhaps the people in Oklahoma should take better care of the children that they have already before they try to control what women do going forward. That's just my two cents.
But what is it, Judy, about that population that accepts this fallacious reasoning when it comes to women controlling their own bodies?
They're not. I mean, I will admit, I will concede that there are some people out there who truly believe that this is the taking of an innocent life, and they're doing everything they can to protect it. But I think there are far, far, far more people who are just see this as a power grab, as a way to control women. I mean, if they really cared, they would do more about helping women have better outcomes, helping children have better lives, getting them out of poverty.
And yet, if the voting population of Oklahoma was really repulsed by this, you would have to expect that the politicians would be quaking in their boots, and they're not.
Apparently, that's the Supreme Court's position on this. So let the states decide. And if the Supreme Court's position was similar when it came to segregation, the South would still be segregated.
Oh my God, this is the issue. This is the issue that all of America should be concerned about. When the Supreme Court, first of all, you'd have to have your brain checked to not have seen this coming after Texas went forward and provided. Sure. You know, in theirs was what, 15 weeks? Was it 15?
No.
No, was it 15 weeks?
Maybe it was 6 weeks.
6 weeks? Yeah.
Maybe Mississippi is 6 weeks.
Texas is six.
Yeah. When the Supreme Court did not step in to take action there, the writing was on the wall for Roe v. Wade. The fact that they allowed for a private right of action to circumvent the what we've recognized in stare decisis as a woman's, you know, right to over her body and her health should have been a warning sign. And now you're going to have a free-for-all in the country. But if you are a person of color, if you are a person who enjoys your Second Amendment rights, look for other, bodies to challenge the Supreme Court and challenge those rights that we've all lived under and quite frankly have enjoyed. Because I'm waiting for the private right of action for someone in a blue state when it comes to, the right to bear arms. I'm waiting for a blue state legislative body to pass such legislation and to see how the Supreme Court of the United States will take that
on. But you have a pretty good idea what you're going to see, right?
Oh, we'll see hypocrisy, because that seems to be the
order of the day.
The order of the day.
David, if I may, I have a question. The draft opinion of the Supreme Court said that the decision was going to be turned back to the legislature. It didn't say states. Obviously, the federal, the Republicans in Congress tried a rule that would have put a federal law permitting abortion in place. Help us, those of us who don't understand the law as well as you, is this going to be purely the states decide, or will the federal government have a role, or will it be some blended mix?
The federal government is broken. They will not codify Roe v. Wade.
But hypothetically, could they?
They could. As a matter of fact, I think if
but
if
they
I,
could also but they could also do the flip side too, right?
Well, they sure could. I believe that there was the bill that was on the floor. So, was it last week or the week before? There was an opportunity to get Manchin on board if it was a straight codification of Roe v. Wade. But there are other elements in that bill that I'm not too familiar with that bounced Murkowski, Collins, and also Manchin. So there was an opportunity. And so the question that you have to ask yourself was our Democratic Party really interested in codifying Roe v. Wade, or were they more interested in the issue to then campaign on in the next election cycle?
Oh, I take that cynical view, because I think there's a lot. If you were in Congress, you would try to get the child credit that was available during the pandemic back in place. You would try to get codified into law the right to seek medical attention outside of a state. You would start working on pharmaceutical availability within states, and you would try to get at least a minimum level of protection for all states, because this is real and it's coming, and in some states there's going to be absolutely no protection. So I think it's very clear the Democrats have taken a cynical view, and they're trying to motivate a political body as opposed to get this solved at least in some stopgap way.
It is a real issue. It is a significant issue that has a ripple effect all throughout our systems. And some of my colleagues in other states have already declared that they will not prosecute, both women who have gotten an abortion or any of the medical providers. So what you're going to have, even within a state, are patchworks, right? You're going to have, in this state, we have 62 DAs. You're going to have in some red counties, prosecutors. I'm not suggesting that would happen here, but theoretically, you could have a state like Michigan where you have those laws that are going to trigger. As soon as we're anticipating June is when the Supreme Court is going to finally deliver a final opinion. So you're going to have states like Michigan where, in Detroit, you have a DA there that is not going to prosecute. But you might, in a neighboring county, have a prosecutor who will. So it's going to cause all sorts of issues for everyone.
In those cases, could an AG step in and prosecute?
And then you have AGs that in some states have a greater footprint in criminal prosecutions. And in some states like ours, the AG doesn't really have a large footprint in criminal prosecutions.
I cannot think of a law that differs so much or will differ so much across state lines. And I just keep thinking about, for instance, Tulane University, right, down in New Orleans. Imagine if you're a young person going to college and you're a person who might become pregnant. Tulane or maybe the other choice, right? Or you're somebody who might get somebody pregnant, or you're a young professional couple. Yeah. Husband's been offered, or the husband or wife have been offered a job in two different locations. And you're thinking family planning is still something you want to have control over. What happens in terms of what we're going to look like in terms of red and blue states? This could get really peculiar.
Well, ask yourself what happens when the couple decide to seek, an abortion. Is the prosecutor in that county going to also be prosecuting the husband for aiding and abetting? And boy, what does that do with marital privilege? There's a whole host of issues here that we haven't even, scratched the surface on. But this is going to create turmoil. And the idea that you could sit back, on that bench and say, well, there's a lot of adoptions will increase. There'll be opportunities for adoptions. I'm like, where are you from? Like, where's Marsha Brady? Is she a friend of yours? Like, where were you born? Where were you raised that you don't recognize?
I'm sorry,
that people.
Well,
there are people that have come up and live this, amazing life where they don't see the challenges that other people experience.
Marsha.
And so when you are a justice and those things come out of your mouth, we can just go to the fire station and leave a child at the doorstep. It's like, really? This is what we're going to be doing in this country? As if, people are still not going to seek, abortions. We want to go back to the back alleys. it's really forcing people, as you said, even, you know, young people who are in school, who couples that are making, you know, life plans, it's really going to force people to really reconsider and impact lives. And it's just so amazing to me that we have people that are making these decisions that can't see that.
Well, part of my point was who moves down to – who goes to school at Tulane and which professors, young professors and young families move down there given – you know, the relative attractiveness of that institution versus another where they're not going to face those same constraints. Yeah. You're going to get states that could start to look very, very different from one another.
You know, and there's more, I think, barreling down the highway towards us. There's talk about trying to prevent women from crossing state lines to get an abortion. There's talk of, there's talk of making this go from coast to coast. There's talk of, you know, even going into contraceptive. We're talking about family planning. Well, maybe it wasn't that long ago that there were some states where selling contraceptives was illegal. I mean, some people believe that the only time you should have sex is when you want to have a baby.
The private right of action is the thing that is the most frightening aspect of this, right? Now, I understand the private right of action is what keeps this from,
for the bankers in the audience, can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, you know, the fact, for example, in the United States Supreme Court in the case in Texas, one of the reasons they didn't take it up is because you don't have a state actor. It wasn't the state that was depriving, you know, the woman of her right to seek an abortion. They created a private right of action which gives the average citizen, a neighbor who lives next to you, who may have heard some noise last night in your room and now is starting to see, you know, that you've put on a little bit of weight, who all of a sudden, you know, within a matter of months or weeks, you know, it's not there anymore. That nosy neighbor is the one that can now sue you, right? The idea that we would have Dog the Bounty Hunter now not seeking criminals, but seeking, you know, out there looking for women and out, also
if
out there looking.
This becomes a reality show. We're at the end of civilization.
But this is what's coming. And this is dangerous. It's really, really, really dangerous.
All right, letters. We have a few moments before our bottom of the hour break. Ann says, please note that the Oklahoma law, this touches on what you were just talking about, please note that the Oklahoma law bans some forms of birth control, the IUD and other methods of birth control, for example, some forms of the birth control pill that prevent implantation, of the fertilized egg. Also, we go to Mary. Hi, I have one question. How is a medical procedure even in the realm of government control? This issue should be between a doctor and the patient. It is so frustrating.
Well, this is the interesting thing. You know, for purposes of the Oklahoma bill, for purposes of the, are we just going to ignore HIPAA? We're just going to ignore that. We're now going to compel
in
doctors.
In this case, I don't know how you get around it, right?
Well, that's the issue. Are we going to compel doctors to now disclose the kind of treatments they're providing for women? And by the way, I mean, if I'm a Democrat, I would have, in Oklahoma, I would have suggested an amendment there. You know, well, how about we start, you know, looking at the male parts? You know, was there a penis involved in this, ma'am? Well, how about we start, you know, prosecuting them or we find them? Then I think you'd see the men have a very different opinion about passing, you know, these pieces of legislation. There's no consequence here at all for men.
I'm going to add that to my little book here.
I'm sorry.
Was there a penis involved?
Well, you know, it's just, look, it's the fact that government, you know, we have this thing called standing in the criminal in the system, right? You can only appeal if you have standing. Government now has standing to impact and legislate, you know, women's health. It's stunning to me. It's stunning to me, and it's stunning that this has happened, and there hasn't been, you know, a greater revolt.
John writes, life begins at fertilization? Biologically impossible, shouty caps. The entire reason my sexual reproduction evolved 1.1 billion years ago is to throw genes together and see what fails. So not all fertilized cells even divide more than once or twice, never mind implant. And that's by design, to get rid of damage and non-viable genes. And not all implantations are viable either. Miscarriage is a common thing. That from
what happens? What happens there? I mean, I'm not clear about the Oklahoma legislation. What if a woman who's carrying a child, who's been forced to carry a child, is engaging in conduct that creates a miscarriage? What do we have there? You know, what's the punishment there?
What if she accidentally has a miscarriage that's misinterpreted?
Exactly. There's so many things here that cause me to. We are venturing down this very perilous track.
Karen writes to us and says, it feels to me like a mini Taliban, right-wing Christian style, being imposed on us, restricting women's rights. Anthony says, could men be prosecuted for having a vasectomy? Could they make a law against that? Well, no, because it would be about men, right?
That's right.
That's not going to happen.
Wait a minute. That's our tribe. No. Erase that.
Earl says, imagine Republicans controlling both houses of Congress and the presidency. Could a federal ban on abortion pull the rug out from under rights that we enjoy as New Yorkers?
Let's wait until they figure out what else they don't like. You know?
But it is a good question.
The thing I'm scared about is them revisiting the Dred Scott decision.
But no, realistically, though, your earlier answer implies that we should worry that there could be a federal prohibition.
Absolutely. Okay. Which, again, the cynical me looking at our current, you know, body politic.
Says they don't get it ever. They don't ever get it done.
They want the issue to ensure that the Democrats hold on to power, especially, you know, okay, so what we got a terrible economy, right? We got recession. You know that the Republicans are going to be running on the recession. Democrats want to energize the body politic, and what better way to energize, you know, especially women of color who have won in spaces that we never thought Democrats never thought they could win. Alabama, Georgia. This is one of those critical issues that will motivate people to the polls.
Less than a minute. Get to as many letters as I can here in that time. Jim says, one, I don't think that is being made involves forcing someone to assist in maintaining or saving life. If I have a perfectly matched kidney to a family member who needs it to survive, I cannot be compelled to provide it. If a fetus is not viable outside of the mother should not be forced to maintain the fetus's life. We go to Amy. Yes, it's so true. Find the penis. Find the penis that made the pregnancy. I was carrying refreshing. It was refreshing to hear that come out of a man's mouth. So congratulations, David, on that.
Oh, my God.
All right. We'll take a break. We'll pause. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll end our conversation on this Friday morning. Alan Chartok, Mark Whitman, Judy Patrick, and David Soares. First news from the BBC.
I held my hands, never knew how to act.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Mark Whitman, Judy Patrick, and David Soares. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We are running out of time. We only have about 15 minutes or so. So we would like to get as many of those letters in as possible. I do want to say that I think we have time for another topic, too. We'll get to that in a second. Let's finish up on the letters regarding the abortion ban in Oklahoma and the response to that. Anna says, has the Supreme Court not thought that it is a state's right to not obey a Supreme Court ruling? States' rights goes both ways, so the Supreme Court would seem to have negated its own power. Dan says, these laws sound like a recipe for abuse. I bet spurned exes and other people will accuse former lovers of abortion after miscarriages and tie people up in court.
I'm sure that's right.
We go to Drew. Okay, can someone please explain the pro-life standpoint, especially in Oklahoma? This, among other states, have deep history in mass sterilization of indigenous peoples. It certainly seems to be the same folk that claim to be pro-life. I do know the answer, but I'm interested to hear the point discussed. Well, I think we're happy with you knowing the answer.
Yeah, that's important.
Yeah.
It is hard, I mean, to articulate beyond the fact that there are some people who truly believe that this is an innocent, this is a baby. I mean, babies are so cute, you know, especially when they're, you know, they're drooling and you're feeding them. But those are babies. We're not talking about babies here. But there's, I mean, isn't your baby cute?
My baby is, she's adorable.
And that's what people tend to look at when they, it's the true believers. That's they have this vision in their head, and they can't separate it from a pregnancy and a fetus.
Naomi writes, what kind of a country do we live in where 7 out of 9 people believe that a woman should not have total control over her own body? What kind of freedom does a woman in America have? If 7 out of 9 mind-numbed people believe that she should have limits placed on her need for an abortion, 7 out of 9 people is an overwhelming majority of citizens who are anti-women. This is selective misogyny. We might as well be living in the Dark Ages, a place all Republicans and weaponized Christians are sending us into. I don't know.
Where's that 7 out of 9 coming from? Because I believe we're at over 60%, close to 70% of the American public who favor, you know, a woman's choice.
I think that's the numbers that I've read.
I thought that was the Supreme Court.
Oh, okay. She must be talking about the justices.
Right, but I'm not sure that that's going to be the final vote. Yeah. We'll see what happens.
Oh, I see. Yes. Aren't you? Okay. Thank you, Judy. We appreciate that. All right. Let's go to... Do I have all the letters? Yes, I have the letters. Okay. Let's go to the grim fact that as of... it depends on what measure you're looking at. But according to the New York Times and to the research they have done into this, we hit 1 million people dead in this country as a result of the coronavirus and COVID-19. And I certainly would not, especially with Judy in the room, take it upon myself to tell you not to read the newspaper. But if you do get a chance to look at the story online, the graphics that they put with it are just incredible, absolutely amazing, of these basically grains of sand that come together and show the how this has really ravaged this country over the last 2.5 years. It is... as the article starts, the magnitude of the country's loss is nearly impossible to grasp. More Americans have died of COVID-19 than in 2 decades of car crashes or on battlefields in all of the country's wars combined. Experts say deaths were all but inevitable from a new virus of such severity and transmissibility, yet 1 million dead is a stunning toll, even for a country the size of the United States. And the true number is almost certainly higher because of undercounting. It is the result of many factors, including elected officials who played down the threat posed by the coronavirus and resisted safety measures, a decentralized, overburdened healthcare system that struggled with testing, tracing, and treatment, and lower vaccination and booster rates than other rich countries, partly the result of widespread mistrust and resistance fanned by right-wing media and politicians. The virus did not claim lives evenly or randomly. The New York Times analyzed 25 months of data on deaths during the pandemic and found that some demographic groups, occupations, and communities were far more vulnerable than others. A significant proportion of the nation's oldest residents died, making up about 3/4 of the total deaths. And among younger adults across the nation, Black and Hispanic people died at much higher rates than white people. Understanding the toll, who makes up the 1 million, and how the country failed them is essential as the pandemic continues. More than 300 people are still dying of COVID every day.
Mm.
A million is such a big number. It's for many people, it's hard to grasp, and it makes it easier for us to look away. But if you look back over the last 2+ years, the stories about, you know, the World War II veterans who died, the horror, the individual stories of the families that have lost people, it's more than a million people because we think we've undercounted it. There are a lot of people, a lot of them escaped our notice, especially in those first few months. And then think about the people who have long haul COVID, and think about we have a raging surge right now that people are, they're thinking, well, it's not so bad. It's, if I get it, I get it. Meanwhile, vaccination has stalled basically at 70% nationwide, and then there are some states where it hasn't even exceeded 50% yet. So we have failed on so many levels. Have we succeeded on any? The vaccine was good in the beginning, but I'm hoping for a better vaccine this fall that will help me. I don't want to spread it. I don't want to get it, and I want a vaccine to do that for me. And I haven't gotten that yet. I mean, I've gotten all the vaccines and all the boosters, but.
And there is I was reading an article about the matching of both the flu and the COVID vaccine of a regular regimen with that. But you look, let's take, and not to pick on them, but to look at New York City, for example, where there is a surge, and one of the bigger, larger surges in the United States as of this moment. And again, going back to what we were told by government officials, the CDC, and epidemiologists, that the way to curb that was to wear a mask. And now the mayor has said that he has no intention of implementing a mask mandate within the city, as the numbers are as high in some cases as they've been throughout this pandemic.
He's looking at his polls.
Yeah, I never thought that we would arrive at a place where we would allow for politics to govern,
sure,
our pragmatism and it started with the former president of the United States, but politicizing this issue it was the venom that is currently in the bloodstream of our nation right now, and a million people we've had in my office, we suffered a tremendous loss. My personal assistant who passed away. And walking by her desk every day, you scratch your head and you wonder why this had to happen. But for some people who don't have that proximity to that loss, they continue to, they don't want to be inconvenienced. This is something we have to live with. We have to live with this for the rest of our lives. And the question is, what are we going to do when something else comes down the pike? Will we repeat the mistakes that we've made? We saw the impact that this had on businesses. We've seen the impact that this has had on our lives. I mean, every Zoom call, with morning meetings when we were working from home, we would see families who were struggling to keep, kids, busy doing their schoolwork while they were also working. Have we learned anything? That's really my concern.
I really think if you look at 9/11 and how government agencies and the politicians failed us, this is a repeat, and we need a similar response. When you hear Walensky talk about updating the CDC, it sounded like their software was out of date and they just needed to press a button. I mean, all those agencies acted, they were like, it was like a clown car. And I mean the kind of clowns that are scary clowns that you run away from and cry when you see them. And if that was a business, you would do what we did after 9/11 with Homeland Security. You would burn down what you have, and you would build it back up in a far more effective way. And by the way, if it costs some money, significant money, even part of the defense budget, let's say, for example, I'm okay with that, because when I spent 6-9 months cowering in my home from a foreign invader, right, that invader was the virus. It wasn't an enemy come to our shores in the form of a person. I am a little perplexed as to why we haven't sort of gotten on it in terms of fixing, taking an honest assessment of all the myriad of mistakes we made and trying to do a better job. And I would point people to, if you read, Bill Gates came up with a proposal. It costs $1 billion a year to sort of put this global watch in place against the next pandemic. But, you know, frankly, it seems like a small price to pay given what we just went through. And I'm perplexed as to why the government hasn't done more to reconfigure our at least the administrative response to this.
They haven't, because we all know somebody very close to us who just doesn't believe that this is so.
Isn't that the WHO? Isn't that the World Health Organization who, like, if we're going to create a structure, I mean, we created the United Nations, right? It's where all the countries can come and discuss their, you know, their issues, their challenges, and where we make critical decisions that impact, you know, every nation. Wasn't that the intention of creating the WHO, where these issues can be discussed? Because if we do not have a global strategy, right?
Yeah.
A global strategy, then all we're doing is waiting for the next, you know, disaster to strike.
Well, in this country alone, we spend hundreds of billions of dollars a year, billions of dollars on pandemic watch. And how'd they do last time through? And I don't know what we spent on the World Health Organization, but it didn't seem to do much better than we did in this country. We need to start over with those organizations. If they were businesses, you would fire everybody, yeah, and start again.
You're all making great points. But every day, more people are dying. Every day, we're seeing a surge in this part of the world, in this part of the nation, that we haven't seen. You know, it's consistent with the surges that have been throughout the last 2.5 years. And yet, we're just sort of like wishing it away, or not even just ignoring it. And that's bizarre to me. It's just completely bizarre to me.
Part of it is the political reality that people don't want to wear masks, that people don't want to adhere to rules. They just don't. Politicians get the message and they say, okay, we're done with it, even though we certainly are not.
Right. And if you don't mandate mask wearing, they're not going to wear masks.
I agree. But I also think even the CDC, in terms of third and fourth shots, like, I haven't seen a sensible explainer of, if I've had 2 or 3 shots and then I got COVID, how long do I wait till the fourth? I mean, some pretty simple, relevant stuff. The CDC seems to also be done with this as well, from best I can tell.
The messaging has been horrific, horrific. It's inconsistent, but it's been that way. And look, I think we could see that this administration has a terrible messaging issue on a whole host of different subjects. But you do want one consistent message.
All right, we're out of time. My thanks to everybody. Alan Chartok, Judy Patrick, David Soares, Mark Whitman. Have a great weekend, everybody.
You too, Joe.
All right, be well. We'll be back right after this.